This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, episode number 58, for Monday, October 5th, 2015. Welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host, Podcast Steve on Twitter. This program is about communications, public relations, and journalism, and we speak with interesting personalities in those fields. So we have a couple of items in this week's program. First, we will look at a new survey of the advertising industry. According to Campaign US, which is a magazine published by Haymarket Publications covering advertising and creativity in the United States, poor morale is the biggest challenge to talent retention in advertising land. More than a third of respondents in the survey reported low or dangerously low morale in their companies. 37% of the respondents said morale at their company was low or dangerously low, and only 29% said it was good or very good. About 34% said, meh, it's satisfactory. Now, you might expect, and this is what the survey bore out, that people making more money were least likely to rate morale at their company as low. The people making more than $100,000 a year, only 32% of them said that things were bad. But the people between 50 and 100,000 had about a 40% level of low morale, and people in the middle making 50,000 or less, about 35%. No correlation was reported between morale and the number of years someone had been working in the industry, so the longer you're there, it doesn't make a difference. You're not going to be any happier or more miserable. Doug Quenqua is the editor-in-chief of Campaign US. He's been writing about advertising and communications for 15 years, with work appearing in the New York Times, Adweek, Wired, MediaPost, Code.create, The Advertiser, ClickZ, and others. We spoke with him by phone from his office in New York about some of the findings of the survey. Doug Quenqua, thanks for joining us on the Lubetkin on Communications podcast.
Hi, Steve. Thanks.
So when we look at the morale in the advertising industry, a lot of people who listen to the podcast obviously are fans of the just completed series Mad Men, and there were some morale problems in the advertising industry back in the 60s and 70s. What's going on now that has made you find that morale is relatively poor?
Well, it's funny that you bring up Mad Men, because it a lot of this was spurred by pop culture representations of advertising. Pretty much any time you see an ad agency portrayed on TV or in film, they're seen as, you know, they're overworked, they're unhappy, they're sometimes literally insane. It doesn't paint a pretty picture. And certainly, our own experience dealing with people in the advertising industry tell us that these are not entirely, never exaggerated, of course, but that there is a lot of complaining about work-life balance, about the work itself. So we wanted to really find out. We wanted to put a survey out there. And we asked some fairly basic questions, just sort of, what is your personal morale like? What is the morale like where you work? Has it gotten better or worse? What's driving it down? And what we found was it's a little over 30% of people say that morale at their company is either low or dangerously low. A lot of people are saying it's satisfactory. But I think, I think about a third, I think that's really surprising kind of that it's not so bad. I think that certainly I don't know what morale is in other industries. But I think we kind of expect it to be a little bit worse. So that's not really so bad. I think that the main finding that we found that was really interesting to us is that people who will work at low morale companies are 3.5 times more likely to be actively looking for work than people who say their companies have high morale.
So that kind of means people should be concerned about talent going away.
Yeah, I mean, in an industry where talent retention is already a very big deal, we're losing people to industries left and right. The idea that morale can make such a difference in somebody staying or going, I think, is definitely something that people should be paying attention to.
You also found in your survey that people with higher salaries were a little bit happier than people with the lower salaries.
Yeah, again, not terribly surprising, except that people were asked how much salary made a difference. Didn't really say that much. They were asked to rank how much, the level of importance of various factors when it comes to determining morale. And by far, issues of management, leadership, work-life balance were considered more important than salary. Salary was about next to those things. But we also, you know, sliced it up by looking at what people said based on, you know, what sort of salary they had. And we found that people who made the most money actually did tend to have the highest morale. So it might have more of an impact than people want to admit.
Did people give you any insight when you talked about the factors that contributed to bad morale? One of them was management or leadership. Did they give you any insight into why they thought they had bad leadership?
Yeah, there were a couple of comments written in. One of my favorite. Someone described the management as ego-driven, self-fulfilling, all about me attitudes. Which is certainly pretty damning. Lack of direction, lack of planning. Some people mentioned sexism and politics. I think sort of a sense of people being in it for themselves and sort of their own self-aggrandizement, as opposed to actually, you know, fostering a sense of we're in this for a higher purpose. We're you know, inspiring people to maybe, you know, to work for a company that they feel is trying to accomplish something, or that they're proud of what they're doing, and instead just feeling that their bosses were a little bit more interested in, you know, padding their own resumes and, you know.
Do you have any recommendations for companies to improve morale?
I think, you know, it's easier said than done, but I think inspiring people goes a long way. I think that especially in creative industries, you know, people don't get into these businesses because they just want to collect a paycheck and go home at 5 o'clock. I think they are really happy to work late if they feel that they are doing something great.
Terrific. Doug, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Douglas Cuenca is the editor-in-chief of Campaign US Magazine, which writes about advertising. It's part of the Haymarket Group of Publications. He joined us from his office in New York City. And next up on the Lou Betkin on Communications podcast, Philippe Boremans. We go to Europe, to Brussels specifically, to talk about the state of the art in corporate communications and public relations in Europe. Philippe is a multilingual corporate communications professional with more than 20 years of experience. He's worked in both internal and external communications, as well as crisis communications, online reputation management, and media relations. He started his career in the agency side of the business at Porta Novelli in Brussels, and then spent about 10 years working on the corporate side for IBM. He has extensive experience in European media relations and public relations. He is currently chief social media officer for the Van Mark Group, where he manages the online reputation of the group. Philippe loves a good crisis from time to time and enjoys bringing people together, as well as being a serial traveler. He also produces a weekly podcast called wagthedog.fm. You can find it on wagthedog.fm. Philippe joined us from his office in Brussels over Skype. Philippe Boremans, thanks for joining us on the Lou Betkin on Communications podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
It's great to be back with you, Philippe. We, of course, exchanged a conversation on Philippe's podcast, the Wag the Dog FM podcast, and talked about my book with Donna Papacosta. But today, what I'd like to do is talk to Philippe about his experience working in the communications profession in Europe, which is something that a lot of American practitioners probably don't get a chance to really explore. What are some of the key and fundamental differences between the way we do public relations communications in the U.S. and the way it tends to roll out in Europe? Philippe, you've worked on both sides of the desk. You've worked on the agency side and the corporate side. I wonder if maybe you could talk a little bit about the experience of moving from agency to corporate and then what the trends are like
Sure.
in European communications.
Yeah, well, in fact, I started out in PR agency in the Brussels bubble, as we say here. You know, Brussels as the center of Europe, where I think in one article it was said that you have as much per square meter journalist and lobbyist than you would have on Washington on Washington Hill, so on Capitol Hill in Washington. So it's that kind of environment where I really learned a trade in at Porta Novelli. It was really the a very small entity of five people, I think, when we started out, and it was an agency of 55 when I left, so on 4 years' time. So it was the booming business of agencies, and then moved over to IBM and, in an in-house function as a public relations manager for two countries here, Belgium and Luxembourg. I think, no, the biggest difference I think from the get-go is languages. You know, in Brussels, when you want to do communications on a European scale, there you go. You already have like four or five languages that you need to take into account. So I think, and I know in the US, of course, it's you know, it's English and Spanish, which are, again, it's a different approach. But here in Europe, it's that's one of the big things that you really have to think about, those so many different cultures and languages and things in your communications planning.
And Brussels being the sort of center of the European Union, European community, it's sort of a legislative center, like you said. Is there lobbying going on there that's the equivalent of what we see here in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah, and I don't have any dollar or euro amounts in my head, but I can assure you that the amount of lobbyists is probably the same, maybe a bit lower, but really equal to what happens in the U.S. It is enormous. We have public relations agencies, we have public affairs agencies, we've got private lobbyists running around. You know, everything is based here in Brussels. We have the parliament, we have the council, so we have legislation here. We also have a couple of agencies who really do the work on the ground. So it's a big big entity here, and everything happens here. And so that explains why when, for instance, Europe as such does a European campaign, well, most of the time it's thought out here in Brussels with the help of external agencies. So, yeah.
Now, in your LinkedIn profile, you say you love a good crisis from time to time. I'm wondering,
I do.
What do you consider a good crisis, and what are some of the ones that you've seen in Europe?
Well, good crises are the ones that you never hear of. Are the ones that we were as PR professionals able to contain or at least to manage, and I do think I really believe that I say that a bit as a gimmick, but I strongly believe that good communicators shine during a crisis situation, during a crisis communication situation. I mean, I'm definitely sure that now at Volkswagen and Audi, some people really, you know, step up and say, look, I'm going to take this by the horns and I'm going to tackle this as a communications professional should. And it's not always easy, and it's a stress thing. But I really believe that all your skills that you have as a communications person then, you know, really are used at the fullest. And it's not always a happy moment, but it keeps me sharp as a PR professional. Now, one of the things, I think I've had a bit everything. I had the very first plane crash of Federal Express in 25 years on my shift. I had product recalls, terrorist attacks, you know, strikes going on for weeks. I think I have everything except like a very financial kind of crisis thing, because I've never done a lot of financial PR or media relations. But all the rest, I think I covered. Luckily, never with people, you know, injured or died. So that is one thing I'm touching wood now, which I would not really like to have. But otherwise, yeah, I've had most of those kind of things. Yeah.
When you look at the things that Volkswagen is going through right now, with the revelation that the computers in the cars were somehow doctored to produce good results on emissions tests, you know, how do the communications professionals even deal with something like that? I mean, you have something that seems so systemic to the company. They obviously were not consulted when the decisions were made to do this, or maybe they were consulted and gave advice that was ignored. What's a communications person supposed to do to help a company recover from a reputation hit like this?
Well, I think there's two things that you just mentioned in the question itself. You know, were communications people involved in the decision? I probably think not at all. I mean, that is one of the problems that we have, I think, in communications, be it in the US or in Europe or anywhere else, is that sometimes, you know, people take business decisions. Now, let's be honest here, it's really a fraudulent decision, but sometimes companies take a business decision and simply because it's so much an inside thinking approach, that we communicators, we have this thing that we're, or good communicators at least, have these tentacles out in society. We know what is moving, what is touchy, we know what is hot, we know what is news, what is not. So we have this most of the time as well well a kind of outside perspective. And I do think we need to talk much more with our business colleagues when they take kind of decisions that we maybe could say, well, look, this will be perceived. Maybe it's a very good sound business decision, but the perception around it is not really a good time or needs to be, you know, framed in a certain way, etc. So that is part of the answer of your question. And then, of course, you know, those people now in, you know, the rank and file PR people at Volkswagen, and let's face it, you know, it will be Volkswagen, it's Audi today, and it will be the automotive industry in general, probably. Those people are now in the trenches, you know, they are taking calls and trying to explain things and work with, you know, reactive statements. I think it's much more in this case, the big hit will be on really on the high level reputation of those companies, will be on the bottom line hits. Will people not buy those brands anymore? No, not at all. I don't believe that, you know, people do. Tomorrow something else will be in the news and they'll forget about it. But it's on the high level reputation kind of thing where, well, you'll see a devaluation of those brands. And that is something that is really difficult to manage. When I look here in Europe and in Belgium, for instance, I see the tactics they're using, because I've used them before. It's like, you know, going up away from the brand and talking through the industry association, for instance, you know, responding from the industry association as an industry and not so much as a brand, just to protect those different brands. But those are just tactics. At the end of the day, it will hurt. Yeah.
Now, one of the other kind of highly visible issues, at least when we look at news here in the States about Europe, there seems to be a big preoccupation among consumers in Europe about data and privacy, and Google being required to create a forget-me kind of a tool where people can erase what's been written about them or request Google to stop indexing things. Why do you think Europe is so different on this front, and people in the U.S. seem to be perfectly willing to give away their information for the next free app?
Yeah, I think we're and that is, to me, having visited the U.S. Several times and lived there shortly, we have a different approach to privacy. We are, and again, we is very general, and as I would say, like Europeans is very general. But just to make the conversation easier, I think we do perceive and handle our privacy differently than Americans, again, in general. We're very much like people don't discuss anything which is very private. Like we salaries, for instance, are very private. It's something that you would never discuss with someone else. Data, you know, we're very much looked at. We're very much looking at these things from our own perspective and not so much from a society impact kind of thing. Yes, we would maybe give our name and our birthday on a card from a shop or something to get maybe some vouchers from time to time. But we're very, very much alert to what could be done with that data. And I, for one, think, but then again, I'm a history buff, I, for one, think is that comms is still ingrained from what happened here. Twice in the last 100 years, two world wars, where information around certain people and types of people and with certain backgrounds have been misused. We've discovered all these things afterwards as well, with, you know, the Soviet Union and Germany and the secret services and what happened there. So I think we're still a bit ingrained with that thing, and that we're very much more privative on those kind of things.
How does that have an impact? How do people need to work differently across Europe if there is a difference in terms of social media? Because, you know, the whole paradigm of social media is almost boundaryless sharing mm-hmm. of information. What do people do differently, if anything?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think it's one that a lot of communication professionals across Europe are not really No, it's not the most sexy thing to learn about, and that is the full legal aspect around what to do and not to do on social media. Sure, most of us know what social media guidelines are, but we don't know the legal implications of those kind of things. I just saw an update, for instance, someone saying, oh yeah, you know, social media tip of the day, put a disclaimer on your Twitter profile. Well, I'm sorry, you could say whatever you want as a disclaimer. It holds no legal grounds at all, so, you know, just stand behind your words and don't put a legal disclaimer in there. So it's an aspect that is really interesting. And now we're talking in Europe of a European level kind of legislation and these kind of things which you mentioned in your question. But I remember at the time when I was at IBM where, you know, how do you communicate online through social media channels in Germany was totally different than in France, with different legislation playing a role. Even on the internal side, using social media collaboration tools inside the same organization being IBM Corporation was different in Germany than it was in France or in Belgium, because the internal legislation around how you relate as a worker to an employer is different. All these legislations are different, so it's a complex thing. And again, it's a country to country approach that communicators need to take around social media.
As you look out over the public relations, communications, and social media landscape in Europe for the next couple of years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever you think, what changes do you expect to see? What kinds of transformations and ways of thinking are coming down that you're seeing over the horizon?
Well, one of the things I'm very interested in, and I see that a couple of Europeans here are really getting into that, is how we can use different methodologies, different ways of working in our day-to-day operations. You know, words like PR hacking or using Scrum and Agile methodologies into communication settings, which is really an interesting field to look at. So I think that will be interesting. It's really looking at, you know, what are we doing day in, day out? How can we optimize this? How can we automate some parts? How can we intelligently outsource some part of those things and just to bring more added value? And that is, you know, that goes for agencies where I think there is a big need to really optimize stuff, and also in-house as well. I'm very much now interested in working on a couple of things around PR hacking, where you use technology just to hack your workflow, make it much more easier. Maybe things that, you know, like I do for my podcasting, for instance, or as well in even in media relations and things, you could do that. And then looking at lean, I'm very much interested in lean and Scrum and those kind of methodologies, who come from a different sector. They come from software development and IT. But I have seen a couple of examples of one agency in Brussels and then a couple of companies in teams where they really do, just like software developers, you know, stand-up meetings every day, 15 minutes, boom, that's it, where they use Kanban tools to track their work, where they use Slack as an interim, you know, update system and not have these reporting emails every week kind of thing. So that is an interesting field. That is one thing, like, you know, how do we work and how can we improve that? And then I think on the other hand, I mean, it's looking at how we'll handle this shift, because I don't know how it is in the US, but in Europe we still are very slow in the uptake of new technologies for communications. I mean, social media, yes, but you still see some things and you say, like, my God, you know, I've been giving training or talking about this like 10 years ago and people still don't get it. Maybe it's my fault, you know, but and so I really hope that I don't know how that will happen, but maybe with another generation or with new people coming into the field, and maybe with starting to talk in marketeers and you know, getting some of their insights and they getting some of our approaches, that we'll come to a nicely rounded communications profession here in Europe.
In the U.S., Philippe, and I just attended a session, the Public Relations Society of America's New Jersey chapter had a panel discussion last week, which we actually turned into a podcast about transforming yourself or your company or your team from being a team of public relations services vendors into a trusted advisor. There is a lot of focus in the U.S. about getting the so-called seat at the management table as a communications professional. Is that as important to communications professionals in Europe? Do they feel like they are not given a seat at the management table, or do they feel like they're already there?
No, not at all. And it is also something that pops up on every year. I'm a member of the European Association of Communication Directors. You could compare that to the American associations. Every single year, we have a two-day conference in June, summit of all members, and it is every single year on the agenda. And it is also in a research report that the organization is publishing. But to be very honest, I don't know if that is the most important question that we need to ask ourselves. I mean, we have much bigger challenges. We have
what's the biggest question to ask?
Oh, the biggest one, I don't know, but we really have issues with ethics. We need to, you know, really go down into this, review our ethics in our profession. We need to look at our added value that we're creating. Is what is our job? I mean, still a lot of people, when you say public relations, they go, oh yeah, you know, you write press releases. Well, no, it's not about press releases. It's about influencing and all these things. So another point of view, and that's a very personal one, but I don't think that most public relations or communications professionals are ready for the board. Let's face it. I mean, you know, sometimes we don't even understand, you know, the language our board members speak. Not all of us, but most of us have no clue when they start talking about their, you know, their specific wordings in board settings. I know through a couple of headhunters, for instance, there have been examples in Europe, and all of them simply got fired because they simply didn't have the skills and the clout, so to say, of handling those positions. So again, you know, are we ready for that? If tomorrow we have a seat at the table, are we ready? Are we really, you know, so competent? And do we have all these different skills? Let's face it, it's not just about, you know, basic PR skills at that level. It's about much more. I don't think that every single PR person is ready to become a reputation manager as it should be on that kind of C level.
The other thing that U.S. practitioners are often lacking is the international experience, the international exposure. What advice would you give to public relations communications people here in the U.S. who need to know about how to practice their profession in Europe? What are some of the things they ought to know about Europe before they even try to do it?
Well, I think it's worth investing in a language. I mean, of course, you know, in Europe, most people speak English, or a lot of people speak English, but we have a couple of different languages. You know, try to learn Spanish or French, for instance, which is always nice to have a second language, because it's language and culture. So there's these different approaches. Come over, visit. I mean, I started to understand the U.S. only by visiting, by going almost every year over there, not for business, for pleasure, meeting friends, making friends, understanding the different details in American culture, so that I was able to come back to Europe and say, look, there's no such thing as the American, and there is no such thing as the European. So come over, visit. And then, of course, if you want to be on a certain level on public relations, reputation management, and those kind of things, definitely spend some time in Brussels and start to understand how Europe works. Europe as a, you know, political entity, as a legislative entity, that is an interesting given as well, because that's a beast on itself.
Philippe, it's great advice, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us on the podcast.
It was great to be on the show. Thank you very much for your time.
Philippe Bouremans is a corporate communications expert in Brussels, Belgium. He's got more than 20 years' experience in internal and external communications, and he podcasts at wagthedog.fm. And that will wrap things up for this edition of the Lou Betkin on Communications podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. If you have comments or suggestions about these programs, please write to us. My email address is steve@loubetkincommunications.com. Please check out my new book, The Business of Podcasting, co-authored with Toronto pioneering podcaster Donna Papacosta. More information at thebusinessofpodcasting.com. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, a division of the Lubetkin Media Companies, on the web at beingthemedia.com. This is Steve Lubetkin. For all of us at the Lubetkin Media Companies, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.